The cool scientist is here. Hello to you.
Hi, Declan.
Tea or coffee, man?
I'm in the minority of coffee here.
Yeah, so am I.
Yeah.
Must be the intellectual people.
No.
Yeah, the posers.
We like to think so.
Anyway, yeah, I gave up tea years ago for some reason.
Yeah.
The cool scientist is here. We're going to talk food, first of all. Why not? And look at how we do our shopping. Is your weekly shop environmentally friendly? It's almost impossible to do that because the amount of plastic that is put on top of people to have to remove to get at the food. But maybe we like it as consumers and frown on it as people just think it's too much and we've no way out. What do you think?
Yeah, well, the plastic is huge. This particular study from the University of Oxford isn't really looking at the plastic issue, although it's part of it. And, I mean, you do your weekly shop and, as you know, you end up with a rake of plastic that has to go into the recycling. But there are other factors there as well. And can we do anything to try and cut down our impact? Well, for meat eaters, the bad news is that actually meats are pretty bad for the environment. They're certainly a lot worse in terms of greenhouse gas emissions than plant-based agricultural foods. And beef, which we hear a lot about these days, not good for Irish beef producers with Brexit and all that. But also what's not good is that it's a very high-producing meat, high carbon-producing meat, I should say. So the inputs that go into it, a lot of the things that go into producing beef are producing emissions. The cows themselves are producing emissions.
We're supposed to have some of the best environmentally friendly cattle and methods.
Yes.
In the whole world here.
Yes, we do. But it's still a problem, even though we are among the very, very best, that ideally speaking, you know, in terms of taking it from our point of view as consumers, if you reduce the amount of meat that you eat, even by one day, right? So if you eat an awful lot of meat, like we do in our house, to be quite honest, if you just say, right, one day we're not going to eat meat, and everybody did that, that would make a massive difference. That would actually cut the country's emissions almost in half, you know, so it's huge the difference that you can make. Chicken, it's slightly better than beef, but still worse. So we're heading towards vegetarian options, if you like, which is horrifying to a lot of people in terms of what we can do to help the environment. Because when you the way agriculture produces the plant-based foods, there isn't a lot of emissions compared to the meat.
But if you're taking them, if you look for your chickpeas or your quinoa, what was it? Quinoa? No. Quinoa. That's how you say it. Yeah, quinoa. It has to come in from different parts of the world, and you're using these air miles and
exactly. And then that's something that my 9-year-old son watches for. Actually, he's keen on that because you think of fruit and vegetables, and they're sustainable, good for the environment. That's all true. But what you have to watch out for is that if you actually look at where they're coming from, you know, and you're eating your broccoli, and it's coming in from Kenya, as I saw recently. I mean, how far has it had to go to get here, and air miles and everything like that? So really, you want to eat as much locally produced produce as possible. So eat our own food.
So no strawberries on Christmas Day, as
no,
people have.
No, definitely not.
Okay. Scientists are worried about the rise of child sex robots.
Yeah, this is a weird one, but it's happening. And there's a total legal vacuum in this, which the American authorities are worried about, certainly. And I don't even know if it's on the radar here in Ireland. I don't think so. But robots, of course, are getting more sophisticated with artificial intelligence, etc. And one thing that's happening, which is a positive thing, I think, is that they're being used as companions for elderly people in places like Japan, where you have, robots that can interact and even and talk and prevent people getting lonely and all of that stuff. So that seems to be a good thing. But then you have these sex bots, which are on the rise. And there's quite a lot of these things actually out there. There's one that got a lot of publicity, for example. There's only one of many called Mark One. And this looks like a woman, essentially, and it's a robot. And you now have robot brothels have even started to appear in cities like Toronto and Paris. They tried to open one in Houston there recently, but they said no, down in Texas you can't do it. So this is becoming kind of mainstream, and it's all happening, of course, with no legal framework whatsoever. So some of these robots, as a writer in theconversation.com, I saw a writer in America, he said some of these robots are very childlike, actually. And this is quite sinister, obviously, because there's absolutely nothing to stop people making robots that are childlike or people using them as companions or as sex bots. So, I mean, you could get into the ethics of this and say, well, is it a better thing that people are inclined like that, that are, say, availing of robots rather than putting children at danger? But that's neither here nor there. The main point is that we don't know the answers in terms of what we should be doing legally. And these robots are out there. You can buy them online. So we need to look at it.
All right, okay. Mm. Jennifer Dubert, there you go. The debate might be around the effect of on people for going out into the real world.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people swear by this in the United States. Well, people who take all sorts of these newfangled ideas in. Infusions of young blood. If I just change all my blood to young blood, it would combat aging.
Well, we heard about EPO in sports where you kind of get this new blood and it gives you a huge boost. And, you know, I think it's banned now in things like cycling because you get this new blood and it seems to have more capacity to metabolize oxygen, etc. So it's been around for a while, this idea. And people like the Rolling Stones now are getting their young blood and they're hopping around the stage in their mid-70s. So it's become a kind of a thing, especially in America. But the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, which is in charge of this kind of stuff or regulating it in America, has now come out and said that people should not. These are quite expensive, by the way. I looked online and you've got a company called Ambrosia, for example, and it's charging $8,000 for one go of getting your new blood. And I mean, this isn't a once-off thing. You need to keep doing it. So it's a lot of money. So the FDA is saying that they've no clinical benefits, that there's claims that they actually give you more strength, they improve your memory, that you can slow the onset of Alzheimer's disease. The FDA says that's actually, there's no evidence for that. There's no trials to support it, and that they're potentially harmful. They could introduce things into your body that could cause infections or other.
Okay, I had no intention of doing it, so, and neither of you. So,
no.
And don't do it out there. Don't do this at home. Here's one I like. 8 to 10, the age group. Magical age where you can influence child's taste in music.
Yeah.
And should you be doing it in the first place? Should you letting them find their own music, or should you say, here's Led Zeppelin, it's great?
That's right, yeah. Well, I've twins age 9, and I was playing the Smiths to them recently from my youth, and they thought it was total rubbish, so I don't know how. Didn't like it at all. But they say that there's a magic age between 8 and 10, and once the kids get to about 8, they're able to appreciate the music and the lyrics and stuff like that. They start to notice that. I've noticed that with my twins, actually. But once they go beyond 11, of course, you're getting into the pre-teen stuff, and they're more concerned about what their peers are into rather than their parents, who are becoming a bit of an embarrassment. So you've got that magical kind of 2 years where you might be able to influence them. Now, as you say yourself, you can't hit them over a sledgehammer here. If you try and indoctrinate them, it's not going to work. But this researcher, Dr. Agerman, who's this University of York music researcher, lecturer in music, she says that actually the key to it is to introduce all kinds of different styles to them, whether it's classical, jazz, the whole lot. So, you know, and maybe on a Sunday morning, for example, you're not saying, sit down, you have to listen to this. This is the Smiths. That's a big turnoff. You just have it playing in the background and kind of create
and
curiosity.
And they absorb it.
Yeah. And I noticed with myself, my dad, who's deceased, loved Elgar, you know, the composer.
Yeah.
I find him listening to Elgar now because it was there in the background as a child. So, you know, that's the
very
way to
good.
Do it, I think.
All right. My dad loved Matt Monro and Cole. So there you go. And I still love them today. Finally, Sean, let's have a look at this. And let's have a look in the mouths of children. They say wisdom comes out of the mouths of children, but there might be wisdom inside the mouths of children.
Yeah, this is a really simple, obvious thing, and nobody's done until now, except it's been done by Dr. Erin Dunn. She's a psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital, and she's saying that you can pick up signs of mental illness, which we want to do, any signs that somebody's going to have a problem later in life, very early in six-year-olds, and you can do it by looking at their teeth. So they've correlated very thin enamel That means the kids are grinding, which is a sign of stress. They can also see that if there's something wrong with the diet, they can identify it in these milk teeth, you know, that they just shed when they're age six. And they've used high resolution imagery, and they've correlated this with behavioural issues such as hyperactivity and inability to concentrate, and all of these things have been matched up very, very closely with the teeth. So, I mean, imagine that you could maybe get some teeth from kids who are in junior infants, senior infants. You could identify a potential issue very early. You could intervene, and you could hopefully maybe reduce the chances of them suffering then later in life.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So it's all there as we discover all these new ideas, and scientists are working away at them. Good man yourself, Sean. You're doing some writing at the moment.
I am. Science Spinning is my website, and I do some radio and writing work, but the book is the thing that's keeping me busy here, and one day, hopefully, I'll come in here and tell you about it when I get it done.
Yeah, and your other book is still available, I'm sure.
It is, yeah.
Contributions of Irish scientists to the world of science over the last few centuries. Good to talk to you. That is Sean Duke, the cool scientist, author, and journalist. I wonder how we're doing on our survey at the moment as regards tea and coffee. Coffee moving up the outside. 35% coffee, 75% yeah. Tea. And I wonder if we're in the, well, we're going to be in the minority, but it's a nice minority to be in, isn't it?
That's it. We're an elite group.
That's it. That's what I like to think. All right. Sean Duke, the cool scientist. Thanks very much indeed.